I'm Tariq Osman, and here on the BBC World Service, it's the first part of my new series, The Making of the Modern Arab World. Today, I'll be looking at the first of three great movements that have swept the region, not least in Egypt and Syria, over the last two centuries. Arab liberalism. It's a history you could hear in Tahrir Square in Cairo in 2011.
The microphones were very bad. In Tahrir, of course, the music settings weren't so great. But I remember a moment where it didn't matter anymore because everybody was singing Umm Ya Masri. The whole square was rocking with the same words that were written in 1919, before 1919. They were rocking the square again in 2011. Everybody chanting, Umm Ya Masri, Masri Daiman Bitnadi.
During the Egyptian Revolution 2 years ago, the young singer Samia Jaheen was one of the protesters who took to the streets of Cairo. But they were singing a song made famous by another Egyptian revolution, one that took place almost a century before.
It's called O Egyptian, Rise Up. Like Egypt is telling its children that they have a debt that they need to pay to make Egypt better.
Why was 1919 so present in 2011?
The demands of the Egyptian people in the beginning of the 20th century have not been met until now. It's as simple as that.
So let's go back to this early revolution back in 1919. In the first decades of the 20th century, Egypt was under British rule. And realizing Egyptian independence was the goal of the nationalist movement and its leader, Saad Zaghloul, that had sprung up at the time. But first, let's spend a moment with Huda Sharawi.
Huda Sharawi was a woman from an elite Egyptian family.
Professor Marlon Booth, historian at the University of Edinburgh.
She was the daughter of a prominent Egyptian nationalist, and then she married also a prominent Egyptian nationalist. And her husband and the elite circles she moved in were very active in the 1919 uprising, which was sparked by Britain's refusal to negotiate on Egyptian independence after the war.
The British had arrested Saad Zaghloul, the leader of the delegation, and jailed him. And there were riots all over the country. There was a curfew.
Saniya Sharawi.
And the women, with my grandmother as chief, came to the help of the men. They went out properly veiled and they walked through what is now Tahrir Square and went to the British Embassy to protest. And there Sir Thomas Russell had them stopped by the soldiers and they stood under the sun for 2 whole hours and soldiers made fun of them. There was a crowd, people stood there and watched. Huda Sharawi had this taste for spectacular gestures. One of the British Tommies, because she was walking towards the embassy, stopped her and she opened her coat a little and she said to him, yes, go ahead, kill me, lots of trouble for you.
But wait, this courageous act wasn't Huda Sharawi's only spectacular gesture of protest.
She became quite disenchanted because these men, as men tend to do when the revolutionary moments settle down, said, well, you know, women's rights, you've got to wait on that. And so she founded the Egyptian Feminist Union in the early 1920s. She attended the 1923 International Alliance of Women Conference in Rome.
And they all sat together, obviously, and took decisions together. They decided that they were going to communicate with the others. So they removed the veil. And then when they came back to Egypt, Sezana Barawi told her, we have to remove the veil in Egypt. When they got to the port in Alexandria, her son-in-law, her daughter's husband, she asked him, would you mind? She was careful not to wreck her daughter's life. And he said, yes, of course, it'll be accepted. He traveled with them to Cairo by, of course, railway. They went down and she took the veil off her face and went with it around her face. And all the women standing there waiting for them at the railway station did the same.
This gesture wasn't a rebellion against the colonial power, but against homegrown Arab conservatism. Here was an Arab woman who was both influenced by European ideas and hostile to European power. But this isn't quite the contradiction it might seem. Huda Sharawi embodies an era in the history of the Arab world which some would call the Arab liberal age. That's certainly how I think of it. This was a period that saw a huge flowering of creativity and modernization on Arabs' own terms. Now, the Arab world is a huge territory with major social differences. But let's zoom in on Egypt and Syria. These two countries lie in the center of the Arab world and are, as we'll see, the birthplaces of some of the grand political ideas that shaped the Arab world in the 20th century. It is through these grand ideas, grand dreams, that I want to tell you the story of the making of the modern Arab world. The first of those grand ideas is liberalism. So where did this liberal age begin? Let's go with the intervention of a certain French general in 1798.
Napoleon's invasion of Egypt was a major shock for Egypt and Arabs and Muslims.
Professor Fawaz Girgis of the London School of Economics.
Not because of European military might, but because of the cultural power, the economic power, cultural capital that Napoleon really exercised in Egypt. The printing press, the doctors, the engineers, the anthropologists. So in this particular sense, Napoleon reminded Arabs and Muslims of the decline that has fallen the Arab world. And it triggered a major soul searching, not just in Egypt, but throughout the region.
But how did Egypt and the Arab world go about that soul searching in the 19th century? If this was the moment when the Arab world woke up to realize how much it was lagging behind, it was also the moment when the Arab world stepped into modernity. This is a scholar lecturing a small circle of students at Al-Azhar University in Cairo, the Sunni Islamic world's most venerable university that has been educating Muslim scholars for 1,100 years. But let me introduce you to a highly unusual figure who in the early 19th century emerged from here, Sheikh Rifa' al-Tahtawi.
Tahtawi stands out as one of the most important figures initiating the period of reform and debate across the Arab world.
Professor Eugene Rogan of the University of Oxford.
He had found himself appointed to serve as the spiritual guide for one of the first Egyptian educational delegations going to Europe. So in 1826, dressed in the robes of a Muslim scholar, he boarded ship to sail from Alexandria to France. He was an immensely curious man who, when he arrived in France in 1826, went about with an open mind and wide open eyes, and then had the great sense to write down everything he saw. He was fascinated with the way the French set their table, the way they earned their livings, what their houses looked like, how their ladies dressed.
When someone does something great or despicable, the journalists write about it, so that it becomes known by both the notables and the common people. To encourage the person who did something good, or to make the person who has done a despicable thing forsake his ways.
He saw in the workings of the press something that was unheard of in Egypt or in the Ottoman world. And for him, this was a natural bridge between commoners and rulers that was exciting and daring. It was also eye-opening for Tahtawi to see that the Europeans had arrived at something called constitutional rule. And these were all innovations that to him came from outside the Islamic experience, but were nonetheless suitable for the Muslim world, and indeed ideas he wanted to take back to Egypt and the Ottoman Empire.
Many scholars saw the wave of modernization as caving in to the West and as a threat to Arabic and Islamic values and way of life,
as well as, of course, to their own positions, influence and power. Tahtawi did not. Instead, he saw an opportunity.
So when he returned to Egypt, the first notable thing he did was to publish a book of his observations on France. It was a very important and influential work in Egypt and in the rest of the Arab world. He also became head of the new school of translation, and so he was very influential in both training translators and himself translating many, many works. And this school first produced works of scientific importance, but then also of literature, and that was incredibly important to the intellectual awakening in Egypt.
Al-Tahtawi acknowledged the Arab world needed to review its ways of thinking. As the title of his book suggested, he wanted to find and bring home the Ibriz, the gold, in Paris, Paris. After all, he was well aware that the Western Renaissance had itself drawn on medieval Arab philosophy, science, and medicine.
Tahtawi's generation lived before the era of European imperialism. They did not feel defensive about European thought. They saw this as two civilizations coming together.
So the generation of progressive Islamic thinkers who were influenced by Tahtawi and who dominated the Arab world's religious institutions in the second half of the 19th century did not simply want to westernize their countries. They wanted to borrow what they considered beneficial and absorb this into their own Islamic perspective. This was taking place across the entire Arab world throughout the second half of the 19th century. In Tunisia, the region's first constitution, even in the mountains of Lebanon, the region's first municipal authorities. And at the same time, the Arab world, more broadly, was modernizing its culture through something called an-Nahda.
It's often translated as Renaissance. Egypt and Ottoman Syria were the centers of this intellectual and cultural awakening, as they called it. And of course, it's a very optimistic term. And I think, you know, there's a good deal of optimism and hope in the writings of this period. Both in Egypt and in Ottoman Syria, we find the growth of the essay, particularly within early journalism, and also the beginnings of modern prose fiction as we know it. So the idea of Nahda combines the ideas of social and political reform, notions of constitutional government, attention to education and the press and book publishing, and concern perhaps above all with a growing audience of readers.
It began as a movement among educated elites. And at the time, if you think in the mid-19th century, the literacy rate in the Ottoman world was probably under 5%. You appreciate just how small the circle of those first caught up in the enthusiasm of intellectual reform and of advances in technology. But it's astonishing how far the effects of the Nahda would reach down to the lives of everyday Arabs and Turks in the course of the 19th century. It's in this period where the theater begins to take off in the Arab tradition.
As the Syrian cultural historian Rana Qabbani explains, the story of her great-grandfather shows that this liberalizing cultural renaissance was not without risks.
Abu Khalil Qabbani, who had been an Ottoman official, decided that in the souk he would have the first theater. So he created a theater and a musical theater that became the first in the Arab world. He was very lucky because the Ottoman governor who had been sent to Syria was called Mithat Pasha, and he was a reformist. Mithat Pasha fell in love with this theater. He had seen theater in Europe, and he became the backer of Abu Khalil Qabbani. Mithat Pasha became very unpopular in the Sublime Port in Istanbul because it was thought that he was threatening the Sultan's power, and he was finally murdered. So as soon as that happened, my great-grandfather had his theater burnt down, had his job taken away from him, and had to flee to Egypt, which was then far more liberal than Syria was.
We see in the reform movement attempts to try and bring the benefits of modern technology like electricity or gas lighting or paved roads, modern port facilities. But all these infrastructural projects drew far more than the largely agricultural economies of Egypt and the Ottoman Empire could afford. And so with the spread of modernization came a deepening of debt, and the consequence was a passage from the informal empire of being reliant on Europe to provide you with technology to bankruptcy that leads to more formal and direct forms of European control.
By 1876, Egypt's economy was weighed down by its debts to Britain and France, who stepped in to take control of the economy. Egyptians rose up against the country's leader, the Khedive. And so in 1882, Britain sent troops to restore him, and Egypt ended up a British colony. In reaction, a nationalist movement striving for Egyptian independence was born. Nonetheless, Egypt's drive to Europeanize itself continued.
And then everything changed. 1918, the end of the First World War, the fall of the Ottoman Empire, the rise of the nationalist Young Turks. President Woodrow Wilson declares that the nations of the world have the right to self-determination. Arab nationalist leaders seize on this, believing it will bring independence to their countries.
The Ottoman armies had left, the Ottoman administrators had left, and therefore the power of the Ottoman Empire had left their lives.
The leadership of the Arab nationalist movement celebrated the fall of the Ottoman Empire because the colonial powers, in particular Britain, promised the Arab world liberation, that they would basically have self-determination. During World War I, Britain promised the leaders of the Arab world basically that if we join the revolt against the Ottoman Empire, the Arabs would be rewarded.
The Eastern Mediterranean was transformed. Under the so-called Sykes-Picot Agreement, modern Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Iraq were created. And Lord Balfour issued his historic promise to the Jews for a nation-state in historical Palestine. Fawaz Girgis and Charles Tripp.
Well, the Sykes-Picot Agreement was named after a British and a French statesman, that is, Mark Sykes and Monsieur Picot. And they were the designers, authorized by their governments, to ensure that the former provinces of the Ottoman Empire, when the war ended, would be divided equitably between the French and the British in terms of spheres of influence. There was a total concern in Britain, and probably in France as well, that the victors might fall out over the spoils.
The Arab leadership that joined Britain and France in the war against Germany and the Ottoman Empire had no idea that basically Britain and France made multiple promises to multiple parties. Had no idea that neither Britain nor France were really genuine about basically carrying out their pledges to the Arab world. It was, in their eyes, a great betrayal.
The great impact of World War I diplomacy and the subsequent peace process diplomacy was not so much the contradiction between different commitments, but the fact that the states that were created and the state system that was the result of that through British, mostly British and French diplomacy, the states were to a great extent artificial.
Professor Itamar Rabinovich of Tel Aviv University. The cause of liberation was not met, but the dream of independence remained alive. And in the years that followed, large parts of the Arab world rose up in revolution. Dr. John Shalcraft of the London School of Economics.
The mass uprising in Egypt in 1919 was the moment where Egyptian secular liberal nationalism came of age, and it became the key challenge to British rule. And you had newly educated professional classes who shocked the British in 1919. They were people they thought they were simply just fall in with whatever the British would demand. But instead they start joining strikes, they mobilize, and they're part of the 1919 uprising.
In the wake of the war and the revolution, the British realized they could no longer rule Egypt directly and accepted the nationalist effort to establish a parliamentary monarchy system. This led to the most important milestone of the Arab liberal age, the 1923 Egyptian constitution. However, the British retained a great measure of control over foreign and defense policy, and crucially, the Suez Canal. And rebellions against the colonial powers continued from Iraq to North Africa, such as the revolts against France in 1920 and again in 1925 in Syria.
You have a major uprising in Syria between 1925 and 1927, which is an armed struggle which joins many segments of society. There are professional middle classes from the cities. There are Bedouin clan confederations from the countryside. There are warlords, there are militant peasants, there are neighborhood toughs. But they are marching under the banners of Syrian nationalism. The uprising was crushed by French repressive force over a period of 2 years in an extremely violent way.
Damascus was bombed by aircraft. Great parts of it were flattened. My paternal grandfather, Tawfiq Kabbani, his house and his industries were all burnt in the bombardment of Damascus. And my grandmother came out carrying my father, who was a baby, in her clothes, and they lost everything.
Rana Kabbani. Amidst this violence, the nationalists of the era, such as Egypt's Al-Wafd party, aimed to create constitutional liberal democracies, albeit under colonial rule. And whilst the struggles across the region against the colonial powers entailed huge sacrifices, the price of the attempt in Syria was exceptionally high in blood. After the revolutions had ended, colonial rule was existing on borrowed time. And in its uneasy shadow, for the moment at least, the reforming energy of earlier years was sustained. The leading Egyptian socio-economist, Heba Handusa, told me about her grandmother's life in a genteel Cairo suburb in the early 20th century.
Women were still to a great extent segregated, and she was married very young, at the age of 13. She lived through the women's emancipation movement. She was one of those who lifted the veil in the 20s. What she used to tell us a lot about was the speed with which they were allowed to go out shopping, for instance, from shops having to send them clothes, for instance, to select from, how fast they were allowed to go to the seaside. So it was wonderful for them.
Was she allowed to wear a swimsuit?
I'm not sure.
But the liberalism of the interwar years was not just political. It was cultural too, and glamorous. Novels and plays challenged convention, and in the Arab world, cinema took off very early. Musical innovators like Muhammad Abdel Wahab took leading roles in Hollywood-inspired movies. Western tunes, tones, and instruments were integrated into Arabic music. Sara al-Rashidi is a young Anglo-Egyptian who lives in a part of Cairo that is still rich with the buildings of the Belle Epoque. She told us how this period lives on in the minds of some older Egyptians.
My father always refers to his early childhood and teenage years in Egypt. He often makes jokes, you know, and says, you know, when we used to go to the sporting club, you couldn't dress the way you do now in jeans and a t-shirt. You'd have to dress like a lady and wear a dress and have a proper clutch handbag, and the men would have to wear a suit. And that's how it was in the cinema. There was a man playing the piano and there was a little bar and you could have your whiskey. So he always talks about this time that I wish I'd seen. I can't imagine in Egypt like that. It's, for me, it's something alien.
I talked to another young woman, Sara al-Masri, who is skeptical about how much that liberal era and figures like Huda Sharawi achieved.
I still take pride in her, of course, as a feminist and as a woman who used to be very active. But I describe the movement itself as an elitist movement. It didn't really penetrate into the Egyptian society. It didn't really reach women in villages, for example, and places far from the center, basically. The rest of the population weren't really empowered.
So despite the liberal experiment's promise, for the vast majority of people, the reality that the liberal elite and the colonial powers created was very dismal. Massive inequality persisted. The growth of the middle class was very slow. And Arab liberalism had failed to deliver on independence, for example, in Egypt, in Iraq, and in Syria.
even though you had constitutions, even though you had parliaments, even though you had, elections. The whole system, what we call the quasi-liberal system, was really very exclusive. The overwhelming majority of Arabs really did not have a say, because really, remember, it was a very small class of what we call notables, and old classes really were in charge of the whole semi-liberal moment.
I would say both Britain and France did a disservice to notions of liberal democracy, because while coaching, in inverted commas, the Egyptians, the Syrians and the Iraqis for democratic life, they broke the rules whenever it suited them.
And so in the years between the wars, under the shadow of empire and inequality, two more hard-edged visions emerged: Arab nationalism and what we now call Islamism. By the end of the 1940s, it was clear that the colonial era was coming to an end. Could Arab liberalism survive? With Arab nationalism and Islamism both rapidly gaining popularity, with the elites under attack, the future of Arab liberalism seemed bleak. For tens of millions of Arabs, as we'll find out next time, the era to come would bring a resurgence of pride and hope. And yet for some, the Arab liberal dream remains a golden age still. You've been listening to The Making of the Modern Arab World, presented by me, Tariq Osman, and produced by Phil Tinline. The BBC